They then start to have sex for the first time in 9 days and 13 hours until Grace.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Okay, Jack. I'm sorry. Cancel the pass until we figure this out, because I know her, and I know that things are not good at home.
And how do you know that? Because she read you a children's story?
Don't fuck with me, Jack. I am on the floor every day with those kids, and last night, that girl sat next to me, and she cried, and she tried to tell me the only way that she knew how.
Hello, everybody. It is Wreckatopia, episode 100. And you'd think that, oh, we're going to do something special today. It's just a regular-ass episode. Nothing special. 100, what does it mean? Doesn't mean anything. It just means 100 episodes. All it is. Just a number. All right. And joining us today are Aaron Dicer.
Hi, Lee Hosen Arenos.
And Jeremy Scott.
Yes, sir.
And usually, as usual, we have the chat. The chat is up and alive. Thank you so much for coming out to watch us talk about movies today. Does anybody have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Ooh, ooh. Jeremy has small recommends.
I seen this movie 2 days ago, and it has kind of haunted me. It's called Paper Spiders from 2020, and it stars Stefania Levy-Owen, who my wife tells me was in Sweet Tooth, which is not a show I've ever seen. And she is a high school senior. Peyton List, who you might know, plays her best friend.
There's two Peyton Lists.
There are?
Yeah. Oh. I don't know which Peyton List you're talking about, but there's two of them.
Well,
they're both prominent.
Her name's Peyton. One of them just changed their name. We can't have two Michael Douglases. That's why we have a Michael Keaton.
it's a thing that I think, what was it? It was one of the Suicide Squad or Batman animated movies, both of them had voices on the movie.
Oh wow.
So it was like Peyton List.
Okay, so there is a Peyton List in this movie. Lily Taylor plays the girl's mom, and the mom is slowly having delusional paranoia. There's a conflict with the neighbor across the street early in the movie, and that kind of sets her off on a spiral. By the end of the movie, she believes the neighbor is tracking them through their laptops and going through their garbage. She starts living in her car because she doesn't believe it's safe. Like, it's a real serious mental health issue. It's not a very common illness compared to something like depression or anxiety, but the movie treats it extremely seriously. There are several moments of therapy-type conversations or straight-up therapy. It's basically a coming-of-age high school girl drama. I think it would be very comparable to Lady Bird or Edge of 17, only it throws in this wrinkle of... And there's no other parents around. There's no other siblings. It's just her and her mom, who is slowly deteriorating, and she's still trying to do stuff like go to prom and graduate, but she's also got to go to the homeless camp to take her mom some food and things like that. I was really moved by it. Really solid performances. It's 100 on Rotten Tomatoes with 40-some reviews. It's on Stars, so if you have Stars or have premium subscriptions to places like Hulu or Roku Channel or Amazon Prime, you should be able to find this movie. Max Castella is also in it. Just a really solid film about, you know, growing up and trying to become an adult in the midst of having to parent your deteriorating parent. Lily Taylor's fantastic in it.
Yeah, she's always been great.
Nice. I'll have to check that out. It's not one I've ever seen, so we'll take a look.
I've never heard of it, so...
Well, my small recommend is likely been heard of and seen by many, many people. I'm just now getting around to watching The Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, wow. I will find you.
This movie is so good. Like, and it took me a few minutes. Like, it took me a few minutes to get into like what was going on. But I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is just so captivating in whatever he does. He just like he has a like a gravitational pull to his acting style that it's hard to imitate. Like, there just aren't many actors that can really pull that off. It's not just charisma. Like, charisma, I can like I have a better understanding of. There's something about the way he performs that just draws you in. And he's you know, doing that here. The momentum of this movie is so good. It just pulls you along. You're anticipating every scene, what's going to happen. The stakes are clear. You know what the stakes are. You understand what the goal is. So you're on board with, you know, what's trying to be done here. There's also something that's really, really interesting, I think, about fictional stories set in real world happenings. Like, you know, what's going on here, the French Indian War, as it's known, is a real thing that happened in history. And there's some of these characters that are real characters in history, but the story is fictional. This is the same thing with Titanic, right? Like, the Titanic thing really happened, totally fictional story at the center of you know, what we're watching. I really dig that. I really think that's a real interesting way to put us in historical events. And
I like that more than I like what Tarantino does with historical events.
Right, right. Yeah, he treats them as a time machine where he can change history. Yeah, so I really, really enjoyed this. Some absolutely wonderful, like, running chasing scenes in this movie where I'm just like, let's go, you got this. Like, there's action for action's sake, and then there's action where you're emotionally invested, and this movie is the latter.
This is Michael Mann, right?
Yeah.
It's drives it for me. Yeah. The music, man.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Is that what you were going to say?
Everything you just said.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say that it's a different Michael Mann movie than anything he's known for. Like, that's, yeah, it's a complete anomaly. Yeah. And the score is phenomenal. They used to use that music in trailers all the time.
Oh, yeah. There's also a great Seinfeld parody where he's on the phone. He's like, stay alive, I will find you.
Yeah. A friend of mine recommended a movie called Dinner in America to me that carved out some time for. And this movie stars Kyle Gallner, who some of you may know from Smile and one of the recent Scream movies. He plays a guy named Simon, who is he's definitely like looking for money, but he's also on the lam. There's a $5,000 reward for him, and there's cops looking for him everywhere. So we're following his story, but there's also this young girl, who I think is played by like a 30-year-old woman, but she looks like a teenager. Emily Skeggs plays Patty, and she's a part of this family that's very, I don't know if you would call them Christian or just, they're just a little bit, they suppress everything. So like, it's one of those things where it's like, if you say something just a little bit off, the father or the mother's like, you're going to have to tone it a little bit down. Okay. And stuff like that. And her character, I don't know if they ever come right out and say she's autistic, but she definitely doesn't she can't read people very well, and she doesn't know what certain things are and things of that nature. But we know that we're on a collision course with these characters. The guy, Simon, who is running away from the cops, is observed by Patty in an alley somewhere while she's on break from work. And she and a cop comes by and says, have you seen this guy? And she says, no, I haven't seen him. And then he immediately says, can I go over to your house? Actually, not really asking. He's saying, I need to spend some time at your house and lay low for a while and all that type of stuff. He is secretly, by the way, a lead singer of a small up and coming band. And he uses the name John Q, and he wears a mask on stage. And of course, Patty brings up the fact that she loves this band out of nowhere, and she says that she wants to go see them because they're opening for some band called the Alliance or something like that, and Simon hears this and goes, what? Though they would never open for a band like that. No, they would never do that. apparently his band has done some wheeling and dealing while he's been gone, where they're about to play a show that he would never say yes to and everything. And meanwhile, there's this kind of a love story that builds and everything. And when you start, if you ever start watching this movie, you're going to be like, Chris, what the fuck movie did you just try to put me on? Because it's very over the top right at the beginning. And you think maybe this is the way this whole movie is going to be, you know, like it's going to be like a pain and gain or like, you know, something like that. That's just turned up to 11 the entire time. But once this love story starts happening between Simon and Patty, that they are magic together. And it's such an unusual and unique story. So yes, I would recommend this. I know this is a big Jeremy movie. Jeremy would love this. I know Aaron would love it too, but I feel like Jeremy would be big into this.
Interesting. Right.
I love it. I've got two recommends that I haven't seen that I can go check out. That's good stuff.
Yeah, that's what this show is all about.
It's so good.
Yeah. All right. Well, the big recommend is Short Term 12, and I'll let Aaron take us away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Yeah. Let's take a look at Short Term 12. This is the directorial debut of Destin Daniel Cretton. I'm not sure exactly how his last name is pronounced. This is based on his own experience working in a similar kind of home for a short-term housing situation for kids that are in rough situations. He actually did a short film in, I think, 2008 called Short Term 12, and then made this in 2012, came out in 2013. He would then go on to direct Just Mercy, which I think is an underrated film if you haven't seen it, as well as Shang-Chi. He did a Marvel movie. He directed Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. This movie also launched a bunch of big careers, as we'll see as we kind of get into it. The movie starts with some coworkers bonding by telling some work stories as Mason, who's played by John Gallagher Jr., is telling Captain Marvel, Officer Diaz, and Freddie Mercury about the time he gravy-trained himself after following an escapee. A young kid then bursts out of the door in real life, and they chase him and hold him down is Nate, played by Rami Malek, adjusts to the insanity of this new world that he finds himself in. Then we roll some early credits as someone says, welcome to Short Term 12. Later in a non-poop related meeting, we find out that Marcus, who's played by Lakeith Stanfield, by the way, credited as Keith Stanfield in this movie, is turning 18 and he's going to be leaving soon. And he says that he wants his head shaved. We'll find out more about that later. We then meet a new girl named Jaden, played by Caitlin Dever, who swears like a CinemaSins narrator and doesn't give a flip about getting a mother flipping level drop. We then quickly find out that Grace, played by Brie Larson, is pregnant before cutting back to her and Mason at home having a portrait sketch competition. They clearly care about each other, even if he does suck at pencil art. They then start to have sex for the first time in 9 days and 13 hours until Grace delivers a right hook hookup uppercut, and we can tell right then and there that there are deeper issues that we're going to be exploring with this character. The next day, Jaden joins in on the group meeting. Some wiffle ball gets pretty intense, and then Grace does some room checks where she finds some weed, some scissors, and a few medically accurate penis diagrams. We then visit Marcus, who clearly has a gift with words, as he performs some stuff he's written, and it's absolutely amazing. We then find Jaden and Grace bonding a bit more. And then Marcus gets his requested haircut, which we discover was not about style, but actually about finding out if his head was still lumpy or scarred from his abuse when he was younger. Grace then tells Mason that they're going to have a baby, and after some minor hyperventilating, he is ready to buy his world's best dad mug. The next day, Jaden gets some birthday gifts and then gets stood up by her dad, which leads to an episode where Nate is still out of his depth. Mason is curious about his baking skills, and Grace helps Jaden get her anger out with a rollicking game of kick the inflatable dog. Things seem to be okay, but then Jaden bolts and Grace walks with her to her dad's place, but she eventually decides to come back and tells Grace, in one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the entire movie, in my opinion, the story of Nina the octopus. A very, very moving and traumatic tale. Grace vows in that moment to never let her go back to her dad. We then go to a celebration that we find out is for Mason's prolific foster parents. And we see the reward that they're experiencing in what must have been a painful journey raising all of these foster kids. Oh, and by the way, at this party, they decide to get engaged. Grace and Mason decide to get engaged. A phone call then comes, and it becomes clear that Grace's dad may be paroled, and we start to get a little more insight into what's going on in her world. We get the sense that Grace and Jaden's stories are very strikingly similar, and we start to understand the investment that Grace is feeling in Jaden. Back at ST-12, Marcus's fish has died, and the overseer that they have to report to has let Jaden go with her father because he says they have no proof. You can't just accept, you know, a tearful story and has no proof. So Grace accuses him of doing favors for a friend. He fires her, and then a touch lamp pays the ultimate price. Meanwhile, Nate finds one of Sammy's dolls and makes a kind little gesture, and maybe Nate is finally understanding why he's here. Go, Nate, go. Good to see him find his place. Then tragedy arrives as Grace walks back in to find that Marcus has made an attempt on his life, and everything is crumbling, including her relationship with Mason and her desire to have a baby. As they have a big fight and call it quits. She then breaks into Jaden's house and stands over Jaden's dad with a baseball bat until Jaden asks her if maybe she thinks that's being a little extreme. So they opt for instead a rollicking game of Babe Ruthing the Buick instead
of
that.
How does dad not wake up?
It's a great question. I'm guessing drunk. I'm guessing that's a drunk sleep or something.
Passed out.
Yeah, he's out.
And she and Caitlin Dever even says afterwards when they're smashing up the truck, he sleeps through everything.
Yeah.
And I'm getting the sense that, yeah, there's some massive drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, or just something. Alcohol. Yeah. Jaden then tells Grace that she's going to be a good mom. Grace apologizes to Mason, and Mason welcomes her back into his blanket fort. As we approach the end, we see a beautiful ultrasound. We find out that Marcus is okay and end up in another coworker story, this time about Marcus not throwing away his shot. Before Sammy bursts out of the door and they chase him down as we adjust to the insanity that hope can be found even somewhere like short-term 12. And that is short-term 12. What did you guys think? It's your first time for both of you, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. You are a gut puncher, Aaron Dicer.
I know. They're my favorite kind of movies.
Like to punch guts. I really loved it. I'd never seen it before. It is incredible that they pulled this cast together. They absolutely could not have known that they had five future superstars in this film.
Yeah.
So it's just incredible casting. I think everyone is perfectly cast. This is probably the most I've liked Rami Malek in anything I've ever seen him in. Because he's not playing a famous singer or a James Bond villain. He's just playing a dude. In fact, they have that fight during Wiffle Ball where Lakeith Stanfield starts hitting Luis with the bat and they break it up.
Mm-hmm.
And the female counselor, Luis, and Rami Malek are sitting on the ground and the female counselor says, "How are you feeling?" Before the student can respond, Rami Malek goes, "Not good. They just fight like that out of nowhere." And I had to pause it. I was laughing so hard. There's so much. I love movies like this where there's not necessarily a straight through line. We see vignettes along the way that sort of paint an overall picture for us. And it's just a very, very human movie that gives us those kind of laughs alongside, you know, the tragedies that it gives us. And I feel like it deals with some extremely heavy topics in a very good way, in a way that's not exploitative or pushing, trying to make it edgy or what have you. It's pretty straightforward. And I like the message of the movie because in general, we know that trauma can breed trauma. And this movie is saying that recovery from trauma can breed recovery from trauma. Because Jaden is very clearly a younger version of, forgot her
Grace.
Name. Grace. So I was very moved by it. I have a few things I'll mention later in terms of notes, but yeah, I don't have anything negative to say about it. If anything, this is one of those movies I could have used another 10 or 15 minutes with. It was over too fast for me.
Yeah, I really like this too. And yeah, there's always, it feels like every decade has a movie where the casting directors have this amazing moment where they've gotten everybody before they're huge stars. So, I mean, yeah, you would never be able to make this movie with these people today, right? So, like, you'd be probably to be too much.
Yeah.
But there's, I feel like it's inevitable with as many movies as there are that get made. And there's always that hot list of stars or whatever that's circulating around and everything. But when you find those movies, it's always just like, whoa, how did they get all these people and everything? That octopus and shark story. I mean, it's, it was the big moment for me too, as well. I think that was the biggest part of the movie, but, I also thought it was interesting, how at the very end of it, it's interesting that that she says that the shark got sad. It was almost like she was being sympathetic towards the shark, but you can tell that in the way she's written it, the shark got sad and looked for another friend, and it's basically saying, you know, this story, the shark's story, is not about how it lost a friend that enjoyed being with. It's about what happened with him, not, you know, what does the friend mean to him in his life, not really what he could do for the octopus or anything like that. He went out to find another friend that he would probably just, you know, eat just as well, and everything. So I thought that was a really interesting, you know, I don't know if they put that kind of complexity in a 16-year-old's mind or if that was unconscious or what, but I really thought that was an interesting take at the end to put that thing in there where it seems like she's being sympathetic, but also pointing out that the shark's really not sad in the way that we're sad when we lose a friend or anything like that, like normal non-psychotic people would be. The shaving of the head and making sure there's no lumps. I mean, good God, I had started this movie and it was about 15 or 20 minutes in when Jeremy wrote across our Slack channels, this movie is a lot. And I was like, I hadn't gotten to the a lot part yet, but I knew we were going to get there because these movies never have, you know, they're never not going to have stories that you're just going to like shake your head at humanity about and everything. Meanwhile, you are going to have hope for humanity a little bit too, that there are people that dedicate their lives to doing this kind of work and everything. I really, really enjoyed this. Brie Larson is great. I know that the internet hates her for whatever reason. I think she said something about, what was that, stunts and
something about being all the critics and all the journalists at the junkets were men. I think it was something like that.
I don't know. Everything that I see her in, I absolutely love her in. So I think she's great in this. Rami Malek also has a funny moment in that. I think it's in that same scene just before the wiffle ball really gets intense or whatever, where he's been told that whatever the kids ask for, you have to say no. And it was a very kind of like short, like it, not literally say no, but find a way to say no, that whatever. And these two little girls are like, would you like to jump rope with us? And he's like, no.
And then that other lady counselor's like, that's not what they meant by that.
Yeah. So that was a really funny moment in this, but I thought it was interesting too. I think in the trivia on the IMDb, it says something to the point that the director wrote all the raps, but then Keith Stanfield came in and made them better. I didn't even know he was a rapper or did any kind of music, had any kind of a music a career or tried to or whatever. But I think that song at the end is credited to him.
And oh, wow.
He's got, I think he's got like a stage name that's on there too. So, but yeah, I highly enjoyed it. I think this is a really good movie.
This means that Brie Larson has been in, cause she's in Just Mercy and she's even in Shang-Chi really quick. So that director must like working with her.
Yeah. And there's another movie he did that she's in too, I think. So, I can't remember what it's called, but there's another movie that was not mentioned in this
list. She's his De Niro link to his Scorsese, like casts her whenever he can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They shot this movie in 20 goddamn days. That was the thing that flew off the IMDb to me. I don't even know how that's possible. I mean, I can't even wrap my head around that. I really can't. I know people in Middle Tennessee who have made movies no one will ever see that shot for more than 20 days. So it probably helped that he had made the short film first and kind of had a handle on the beats. But as an actor, imagine trying to play some of those heavy scenes and the next day you're playing some of those light scenes and then back to some of the, I mean, I just think it would be very difficult in such a compact amount of time. So it makes the movie feel like a bit of a miracle to me.
There are several great performances in this movie. I think the standout for me is Lakeith Stanfield. He blows me away in this film. And one of the other things I read is that he was actually in the short film and quit acting after that and wasn't planning on doing anything. But the director sought him out for the feature because he loved him so much and managed to eventually get a hold of him and get him in it. And then, of course, launched his career.
Quit acting and didn't have a phone, right?
Yeah, something like that. And I just think he's so good in this. That Marcus character to me is kind of the heartbeat of the work that they're doing. Like, you know, because he's graduating in a sense, and you know, the story at the end is about him and, you know, the person that he went back and found and they were on a date together or whatever. And it's this amazing story. But man, the first time I watched the scene where he does his rap for the John Gallagher Jr. character, blew me away. The lyrics in that rap are so powerful and the way he delivers them is so good. That's the So You Know What It's Like song. I pulled up the lyrics just to read the end. So put me in your book so you know what it's like to live a life not knowing what a normal life's like. Put a label on my head so you know what it's like to live a life not knowing what a normal life's like. It's just so good, and it's delivered so well. I really enjoyed his performance through the movie.
He has to run through the gamut of emotions. You see him at first, it seems like he's just angry, and then there you see some depression, and then you see where he's happy a lot, and he's telling jokes and everything. There's the great moment too, where is it right after Caitlin Dever tries to run out the first time, or I can't remember what it is, but there's a big, she's a cutter. So she goes into her, that's what it is. She goes into her room and closes the door, and they're trying to break it down to make sure that she doesn't hurt herself. And while that's going on, he goes and gathers everybody up, throws these supplies down on the table and says, all right, come on, take one. And then when she comes back, she's got happy birthday cards written for her by everybody in the place.
I think that is, I mean, I'm not trying to be cute. That moment maybe broke me more than any other because it's so obvious they have had to do this so many times. He just sets the construction paper and the markers down, and everyone knows, got to leave a note for this person who's really struggling right now. That was what was hard for me to watch, was like, this is routine. This is something they do regularly because they're all broken and they all fall out at some point and they have to be there for each other. God, it's rough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that I think makes it work so well is the authenticity. And you can tell that these stories come from such a real place. Like you can just feel through all these things that the person who wrote it saw this happen in one way or another, you know, to somebody that he cared about and, you know, was there for. And because of that, I think there are little details, you know, the old phrase, write what you know kind of thing. Like there are these details that really jump out at me of just, oh yeah, that's how it would be in that situation, in that home, in that process. And I think the movie benefits so greatly from him telling his own story, you know, to have it be a little bit autobiographical in that way.
I also appreciate's the wrong word. They make these veiled references to the Night Crew, and the Night Crew is always doing shady shit, like taking away the stuffed animals. And again, this is probably real life, man. The people on the Night Crew, you're asleep, so they're probably not as invested in your well-being or your mental health as the day crew who actually works with you and counsels with you.
Yeah.
So the Night Crew, it's very realistic to me that the Night Crew at a place like this would be assholes.
And there's also, I think what Daniel's getting out in some of this is that feeling that the people who are disconnected from the process are often the people making the hard choices, like not the difficult choices, but the bad like the definitive choices.
Yeah, they're saying the therapist was the one that took away the
balls. Right, so like a therapist is called out, the boss of the place is called out for being disconnected. Like you get that there's this sense from the people on the ground, like you don't know what's going on. Like you don't know how to actually connect with these kids and to be there for them. You're using theory to, you know, do these things instead of like actually being on the ground with them.
What's so killer about that scene where Brie Larson goes in there to tell him about that, you know, she can't say that she's being abused because she feels her father behind her at all times and everything, is that on paper, he can't do anything. You got an almost gone baby gone situation, right?
Yep,
because there isn't any evidence that they have seen that she has been willing to give them. And so you can't just, you know, take a kid away from a parent when there hasn't been any like evidence of it. But, you know, you have to be into that trust circle to be able to understand what's going on at home. And it takes her forever to actually show those marks that are on her stomach or whatever. Just a simple little like a wave in front of the therapist to show that or whatever, but that's how scared she is. It's how frightened she is of her father because she thinks her dad is behind her at all times. And it's weird being in the position where you're like, well, yeah, if I heard this story, I mean, how many of these kids are also possibly lying about something so that they can get something out of it or whatever? You have to weigh all this type of stuff out, but you know, God, it's such a tough scene to see that going on. I do love that she smashes that lamp, though. I thought that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's about all she can do. I think even she realizes that on paper, you know, he did what he had to do. But
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that you go through and you feel the gut punches, and you go through the movie being a lot, as Jeremy said, and you get to the end, and the movie I think very clearly says there is hope. You know, it almost goes out of its way in the Marcus story, and you know, through the ultrasound scene, you know, like those kind of things, like, be okay. There is life beyond this. There is life, you know, further than this. There is recovery. Recovery can happen. And it's always a process and it's always a roller coaster. But
that's the thing, because even Grace is still recovering. Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Because, yes. And that's what the whole scene where her boyfriend says to her, you know, I've been here for 3 years and I wouldn't take a single minute back because that's how much I love you, but I'm waiting for you to let me in. Mm-hmm. I cannot help you and walk through this with you hand in hand until you let me. She's facing the same kind of battle that Jaden's facing in terms of opening up. It's just, she opened up about her abuse 10 years ago. Now she's got to open up about that to her boyfriend, and it never ends. The recovery for this kind of shit never ends, but movie is absolutely hopeful.
We have in the chat, Flyboy asks you know, question about the last scene. Do we find the last scene of chasing the kid hopeful? And the way I read that scene was that it doesn't matter what kind of happy endings that you might run into. I mean, he tells that story about Lakeith Stanfield finding the girl who was there and they're dating now and all that. And it feels like a really hopeful story. We see that Brie Larson is on her road to recovery and all of those stuff. And you're like, oh, everything's happy. But then the kid runs out again. And it just goes to show that this life keeps going on no matter what. I get the idea of it being hopeful at the end because these people are still just doing their jobs and they're there for this person and everything. I do get that, but I also get that it's just, this is their life. This is always their life. You know, it's
cyclical. Yeah, that's very intentional to end the movie with pretty much the exact same scene as the beginning of the movie. It's setting you up to go, okay, what's the next story? You know, like what's the next, you know, thing that they have to go through? It's a daily and, you know, monthly annual thing that they have to deal with. So,
yeah,
absolutely. Well, what about Super Secret Double Features, guys?
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I'm going to let Chris go first because I think last time it was he and I doing double features.
Yeah, there's no way. I don't think you've seen this movie, so I don't think you'll have we'll overlap on this one. But a very recent example, The Holdovers is what I thought of on this movie. You know, again, we have, you know, a teacher in charge. This is who's playing the, you know, the counselor or whatever you want to call them from Short Term 12, who is having to see over kids who either their parents are not there or they're absentee parents of some sort or whatever. And they've got their own, they've got a lot of issues that they have to deal with and everything. Holdovers is a little bit, I don't know, more darkly funny than this movie is. But it felt like it was a pretty good parallel to this one, because a lot of the same things, a lot of the matters of trust and getting to know someone that you may not like initially, it has a lot of that same kind of flavor to it. So I felt like The Holdovers would be a good double feature with this.
I like it.
Boy, I had a devil of a time here because there are only so movies about mental health group homes. And, you know, I just didn't really want to choose Girl Interrupted or, you know, one of those. I don't even know that that would be a good double feature other than the group home aspect being the same. But I ended up zeroing in on Caitlin Dever's character, Jaden. And so the double feature is going to be more about her journey. And it's a 2004 movie called Speak, starring a pre-Twilight Kristen Stewart as a girl who everyone in school hates because last summer she called the cops while they were having a party. The reason she called the cops, we find out through flashbacks, is that she was raped at the party. But she was so traumatized, she was not able to tell the cops when they arrived what had happened, and she has not been able to tell anyone. And so she's nearly mute as she's going through this high school experience. Kristen Stewart is so good in this. That, like, everything she does that's not Twilight, she's outstanding. Like, there's really good acting here. Steve Zahn plays an art teacher who kind of helps connect with her and get her out of her shell. But her journey is about finding a way to tell someone what happened to her and begin that process of healing and recovery from this assault. And I feel like that is sort of the Jaden story in Short Term 12, is that she has to take that first step, and she does by the end of the film. I would highly recommend Speak if you ever come across it. It looks like it's on Showtime right now. And it also co-stars Elizabeth Perkins and Michael Angerino. I don't know how to pronounce his name. But I had actually recommended this back on the Sincast 4 or 5 years ago when I saw it then. That's my super secret double feature.
Well, there you go. So what are we going to see next week? It's Jeremy's turn.
It's Jeremy's turn. Shit. I didn't know that. Oh, wait. Yes, I did. Another movie that I saw in the last week that I had seen before, and I think I recommended on the old podcast, 2015's Eye in the Sky. Saw this 5 or 6 days ago, and God damn, it could not be more timely, even though it was made 9 years ago. This is Helen Mirren, Aaron Paul, and Alan Rickman. And Barkhad Abdi, the guy from Captain Phillips, who says, I'm the captain now. So this is about a drone strike in the Middle East. Aaron Paul is in Vegas. He's flying the drone. Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren are not on his location, and they are both superior officers to him. This is a joint U.S.-British operation. And they have a camera inside this house showing guys building suicide vests. Bomb vests, but they also have aerial cameras that show a little girl outside selling bread. And that is just one of the many tensions as they try and decide, can we bomb this place? Should we bomb this place? They have to weigh the lives of innocent people versus the lives of innocent people that might die in a future suicide bombing. And it really punched me in the gut. This stuff has been going on for decades, but you know, everything that you're seeing in the news these days, it just felt like this was super timely. This is on Max, formerly HBO Max, and it's a 95 on Rotten Tomatoes, which I was surprised.
I have never seen this. This has got to be like Alan Rickman's last movie, right? So he did like a voice on Alice Through the Looking Glass, but I don't think that really counts. This would be his last, at least on-screen performance, if we want to, define it in some way. But
I'm a sucker for conundrum movies, and this is a conundrum movie. In fact, it's kind of the trolley problem in real life in many ways. It's like, do you proactively kill innocent lives knowing that it will save, you know, more innocent lives?
Yeah.
And I find the characters, way they talk about it in inner, you know, the dialogue they have is just really well. I'm very excited to go over this one. This is a great choice. Yeah.
Yes. All right. So I'm the only one who hasn't seen this then.
That's all right. It's really hard to get one by Aaron that he hasn't seen.
No, I admit I was just making that clear as a fact. I am the only one who hasn't seen this.
You say that, but there are three movies mentioned today that I haven't seen. One of which I'd never even heard of, the Speak movie that you talked about. So I'm excited to look all of those up.
I have to go back to before you were an official movie critic, and then I'm going to have a higher success rate.
Yeah, I just watched The Last of the Mohicans. There are movies I haven't seen. So.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
Awesome.
Okay, I guess we got some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
We got time for questions. That's rare. And we've got four of them loaded up. So you're going to have to give us some new questions, listeners, viewers, for next week. What is a singular movie that absolutely needs a sequel or two.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World needs more movies. I know, Jeremy, you're not the biggest on this movie because it's a little bit too hyper for you, but I love it, and I think it needs more movies, and I think it would be awesome because it didn't do well in theaters when it first came out. I think it's got a following now that would make it a decent hit if they came out with a sequel. Also, I'm always going to try to bring knowledge to the world about Zero Effect. I know that they'll never make a sequel to this movie, but Bill Pullman's character as Daryl Zero deserved to have more movies, even though the movie made absolutely nothing at the box office. So,
That would be awesome. Aaron?
Have you seen the TV show, the Scott Pilgrim TV show at all?
I have not. Is it good?
I have not seen it either. I knew it came out last year. I think it's a Netflix show. I think it came out last year. And I haven't gotten around to that one. So
I have read it's not the same story at all. Like, they took wild liberties with it, but everybody still seems to enjoy it. So
Interesting. All right. So I had difficulty with this one because I actually have a go-to answer for this question. Or I should say had a go-to answer for this question because the sequel is coming out this year. My go-to answer for this question was Inside Out. I've always thought that you could do so much with that concept and do so many different things. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see what those things will be with the sequel as it comes out this year.
Inside Out 2 will be like Inception or something like that.
something. I don't know. But I'm going to go with The Truman Show. Which is an interesting thing to me because I don't think it can deal with completely different situations and themes than the original movie does. Mm-hmm. Because that character, what happens next, which I get is a beautiful part of the movie, is thinking, okay, what happens next? But I think we've had enough time to ponder that I'd like to see a movie version of that character figuring out the real world and the paranoia that would come, like the absolute mind stuff he would have to go through being in the real world.
And let's just totally ruin it and have it where Christoph knew that he would get out one day and he put cameras everywhere around the world.
Well, interesting, but I'm not as much interested in that because it's the same. Then it would be the same as the first. But that also is interesting. That would be wild. Well, what a twist.
You said paranoia, though. I thought, man, with today's surveillance, I mean, that sequel could end really dark with him realizing we're all essentially in the Truman
Show. Exactly. Yeah. You could do that. Like, there's the people with phones out everywhere and all that. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah.
There's an article in my local paper that said the local police department is asking people in this city to buy this, they'll give it to you. Add this device to your security cameras that lets the cops access them in real time so they can catch criminals driving down your street.
My God.
And I was like, no.
That's crazy. In the chat, Polly Walnut says Alita Battle Angel. I think that's a good choice.
Yes.
I think they were thinking about doing that, right?
It was supposed to be a franchise. Supposed to be a franchise. I just don't think the first one succeeded like they wanted it to.
Shaggy Nuts, everybody's got nuts in their title, is saying Dread, which I would think would be a great one too. I don't know if Dread did. I mean, all these, of course, that were one-offs and haven't had sequels is because they didn't do well at the box office, but Dread, I think, also has built up quite a following over the years. I don't know if it's because of the Raid too, but like,
it's very similar to that first Raid movie, but it's fantastic. I love Dread. My answer for this was Upgrade, just because I love that world and I love that idea. And I like Logan Marshall Green. So I would like to see what happens next in that world. But mostly I just want more people to watch Upgrade. All right, let's do another. What actors do you confuse for another? I often play the game, is that Mark Strong or Stanley Tucci when I see either on screen?
So I get Marshall Bell, who is in a lot of Paul Verhoeven movies, confused with Stephen Collins. And I'm sure that will make Marshall Bell very happy that I confuse him with Stephen Collins. You can look Stephen Collins up if you want. But it's funny. I started watching Band of Brothers, Jeremy. And I'm two episodes in, and I did this last night, confused an actor with somebody else, because there's all, you know, it's like, oh, this is the younger version of somebody. I think that's him or whatever. And so, like, Kirk Acevedo, I thought was Toby Kebbell when I first saw him.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, I guess I confused those guys too. Those are my answers.
Watching Band of Brothers now for the first time is going to be a trip, because it's like, oh, there's James McAvoy for one scene. Oh, there's Tom Hardy for one scene.
And you know, I'll do something like that, confuse two actors, and then I'll see somebody in shadows wearing a helmet with all this makeup on their face, and I'll be like, that's Andrew Scott.
I mean, everybody's in that thing, man. Like the chat says, Jimmy Fallon has a moment. Michael Fassbender's in there.
Well, and David Schwimmer has like an amazing opening episode. I'm like, whoa, that was some casting right there. Yep. But David Schwimmer is a hard ass in the first episode. Anyway.
Yep. Oh, it's good stuff.
It's probably cliche. To me, it feels like the most cliche answer, but it's true for me. The Natalie Portman, Keira Knightley thing has thrown me, you know, for a loop many, many times. I think I can tell them apart now, but they look so similar.
They used to effect in Phantom Menace.
In Phantom Menace, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. Although the other one that always gets me is Daniel Radcliffe and Elijah Wood. I mix the two of them up sometimes. They look similar to me.
They're both in real oddball movies too.
Yeah.
Like they've made their money, they just do this stuff that they like to do, and they're always in these like real quirky pictures and stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So that one gets me sometimes.
As we learned recently in an episode a week or two ago, I have a hard time with Eric Bana and Billy Crudup. mostly because they both rose to prominence at about the exact same time. Always have confused Rachel McAdams and Elizabeth Banks. I think I finally got that one straightened out. But about 10 years ago, when we did a video on the first Hunger Games movie, I called her Rachel McAdams, and you were like, that's actually Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah, I remember this.
I was like, oh, yeah. And I like Slab stole my joke. Peyton List.
Right, which is funny. I think Elizabeth Banks for the longest time was confused with, who's that comedian? I can't remember that name, but she used to have her little a cable talk show at night. It's like Chelsea Handler. I think she was confused with Chelsea Handler all the time. And like people would come up to Elizabeth Banks and go, oh my god, Chelsea Handler, or something like that. She'd sign Chelsea Handler for her autograph and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
That's a good one. I thought they were going to say Jeffrey Dean Morgan and
Bardem.
Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
But they say John Hamm on this one in the chat. But I thought, the Javier Bardem and Jeffrey Dean Morgan. That when I saw the Watchmen trailer for the first time, I was like, oh, yeah, Javier Bardem. And they're like, no, no, it's not.
Sometimes it's not a visual thing either. Sometimes when I'm talking about, I just get, if they have the same first name, I'll just mess them up. Like you mentioned Chelsea Handler. I can't remember how many times I've called her Chelsea Peretti, or, you know, Chelsea Peretti, Chelsea Handler, or like, it just, sometimes it's just the first name and I just pick the wrong last name.
Oh yeah. The Margot Robbie and Emma Mackey. Yeah. That's a good one.
And Samara Weaving for me.
Oh, that's another one. Yeah. All three of them together, really, honestly, are
they were in Babylon together, weren't they?
Yes.
In a scene together, I think when they were shooting out in the desert, all the different, scenes.
Samara Weaving's in that?
I think so. I think she does. She's the one that Margot Robbie replaces when she gets her big break, right? Like Samara Weaving.
I think that's right.
I could be wrong. I could be wrong about that.
There's some movie where this happens, though, I believe. Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah.
Do we have one more? Room for
we
one
do.
More?
We do. I think we need one more. Mm-hmm. What is an animated movie or show that genuinely surprised you when you found out who voiced a role?
Okay, so when I watched The Simpsons from the beginning of, you know, when it first came on. Like, I watched from first season on and everything. So I was pretty young, and I thought that some of the guest voices were being done by people who were experts at doing those voices. So, like, the fact that Dustin Hoffman and Michael Jackson actually did the guest voices on the show, but they used aliases at the end. They, and Simpsons even made fun of this later on when the Itchy and Scratchy movie came out, and Bart couldn't watch it, and Lisa came back and was like, there was so many guest voices, Dustin Hoffman, Michael Jackson, they didn't use their real names, but we knew it was them. And so I thought that the alias that they used at the very end was just somebody who was like a very good Michael Jackson impersonator or a very good Dustin Hoffman impersonator. And it just turned out to be them. They just didn't want to put their name on the show because it was considered, you know, gauche or whatever to be an animated cartoon voice or whatever. So there you go.
It's amazing. Mine's not animated, so I did not answer the question. I answered my own question, but it is a voice performance. I went with Bradley Cooper's Rocket Raccoon. I don't know how I missed that he was cast as Rocket Raccoon, but when I went and saw the first Guardians, there was a moment about halfway through where I heard Bradley Cooper's voice, and it was the first moment in the entire movie where it actually sounded a little bit like Bradley Cooper. I was like, wait, is that Bradley Cooper? And it blew my mind because he's doing such a great character voice in those movies. So that was one for me that I remember.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Because he doesn't sound anything like himself, whereas Groot sounds exactly like Vin Diesel.
Yes, he does.
I've been all about the Blue-Eyed Samurai the last several months. And George Takei is in that, and I didn't realize it was him first time through. And then also, the character of Ringo is voiced by Masi Oka, who was on Heroes, who was my favorite character on Heroes. And Ringo doesn't have a lot of dialogue in Blue-Eyed Samurai, so I didn't even think for a second that was going to be somebody who I would recognize their name. So when I was looking through the cast, I was like, oh, it's that guy. And everybody's walked Blue Eyed Samurai.
Yeah, I've watched the first three episodes of it. I need to get back to it. I like what I've seen so far.
It's great.
In the chat, we've got Lee F. Schreiber as the missing dog in Isle of Dogs. We have Keith David as Dr. Facilier in The Princess and the Princess and the Frog. And Mako as Uncle Iroh in The Last Airbender. Sean Gunn as the baby rocket in volume 3.
True.
Those are all good ones. All right. Well, that's going to do it for episode 100. Once again, thank you, chat, for coming out. You guys always come through for us. I love it that you just come strong every time. It's amazing. Next week will be Eye in the Sky for episode 101. But that'll do it for this week. We will see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey. That moment when you're waiting to see if everybody's sound is coming through.
Ooh, look at that. Looking fresh. Fresh. Looking fresh. You got the nice buzz cut or something.
I did it on accident in November because I used the wrong guard. Mm-hmm. And after making fun of myself for a few days, I realized I kind of liked it.
Oh.
So I did it again, like a week ago.
That's nice. That is something that happens, right? You get, you're like, okay, I'm gonna just kind of knock this down a little bit, and then you make a mistake, and then you're like, well, I got to cover it up somehow. Why not just cut it all off?
Yeah, I mean, my wife has been cutting my hair with clippers since the pandemic, and so I just handed her the clippers because I thought the correct guard was on there, and she just went. Whoosh. And then there's no choice.
No going back then.
Got no either that or you know, I'd make a stupid reverse mohawk, like statement haircut, and I'm not that guy.
You're not a make a statement with your hair guy?
No, but you are.
Do you remember that in college?
No. Did you have a mohawk?
No. I had a cross shaved in the back of my head.
I do remember that.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did you keep that rocking?
Until I made the traveling group, and they were like,
they're like, your Christianity's too edgy for us, Aaron.
Yeah, they were like, no personality, please. You're part of a group now. You're not an individual.
Oh my goodness, we can't have a cross shaved in your head. This is the best story I've ever heard. I can't believe this is so Olivet. It's not even funny.
And then, like many years later, before I was working with CinemaSins, right before that, actually, they called me up to do some interviews for a communications position for, like, you know, being on the path to being like a professor there in communications and stuff.
Yeah.
And I met with the same person who had originally had that conversation with me because he's running like all of the, you know, staff hirings and that kind of stuff. And he asked me in that meeting, he's like, so are you still pushing the envelope? Are you still? I'm
just like, this is the same school that hired our old mentor's son and then found out he wrote an obscure book that had like a trans character in it. So they fired him.
Yeah, I think, I think it was a gay character. I think it was a positive gay character. And they were like, that's not good. It must be a villain if they're gay. I don't know what they were like, but that's the inclination they gave.
And you can get in trouble at the same school for writing about a gay person or shaving a cross in the back of your head. I was just reading about a tool that has been developed that artists can add to their digital artwork that will poison machine learning software. So basically, it somehow confuses the machine learning software into thinking the bits and bytes it's seeing are something else. I don't know the technology behind it, but then it will also mistake those same bits and bytes in other artworks, like not just the one you uploaded. So theoretically, within months, if enough people did this, they could completely ruin those AI machine learning art spewers.
Oh, interesting.
Like, because they might be looking at a picture of a dog, but this will convince them they're looking at a picture of a bench.
But isn't this like every technological thing? It's just a back and forth, and then the AI people figure out how to tell the computers to find that, and then the people who want to fight it tell the computers, you know, like it's just this back and
just
forth.
Let me have my Robin Hood moment for a minute, Aaron. People are fighting back against the oppression.
If there's one thing I'm known for, it's my pessimism. All right, this is never going to work.
That's why you shaved a cross in your head.
That's right. That's right.
You've been better off playing with face cards, Aaron. The only reason I know how to play Rook is that face cards were banned from my camp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Not like, because you can't gamble on Rook. Right?
Right. The only thing you can gamble on are face cards.
Face cards?
Yeah, regular playing cards.
My parents still won't allow face cards in their home.
Yeah, they were banned. Too close to gambling.
Okay.
Yeah, ace, king, queen, jack, 10, that kind of card set, not allowed.
You've officially gone too far. I remember doing a stand-up comedy thing in high school, and I did the audition or whatever for it, and it contained stuff about a teacher in the school, and so the drama teacher said, we can't do that unless you do that bit in front of her and she says it's okay.
Oh, no.
So like they pulled me out of class on one day and I had to perform this bit in front of her in like a supply closet of some
amazing.
And so I sat there and did this thing about, because this teacher used to say stuff like, this is worth 50% of your grade, and then this is worth 35, and then this is worth, it would always go over 100. So I told that joke, and I told another joke, I think maybe about her cigarette smoking or something like that. And she sat there very stone-faced. And then I went back into the class, and then like it took me out again like 5 minutes later. She goes, it's a no-go.
Oh, man, that's awesome.